From Wisconsin Public Radio, this is Newsmakers. I'm Ezra Wall in our La Crosse studio. Thank you very much for joining us today. We're talking about things you're going to find in the great outdoors. Later on, we will hear from the Wisconsin bug guy. We'll tell you all about that, hear about ants and mosquitoes and ticks and all these things, not only how you can avoid them if that's your wish, but also how beneficial they are to our ecosystem, and maybe learn a little bit of mutual appreciation as the show goes on today. We're joined in our first segment, though, by Thomas Volk, who's a professor of biology at the University of Wisconsin-La Crosse. Tom, thank you very much for joining us on Newsmakers.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
I know that you are an expert in mycology, and we're hoping to talk all about mushrooms, and I know that you also are an avid hunter of various wild things that we can pick and cook and put in our salads and all kinds of other things. So what?
Everyone likes free food.
Is that what it comes down to? It's just so expensive to go to the grocery store. That's it.
No, but it's so much better to get things from the wild than to buy them in a store. It's much more satisfying and often more delicious.
So everybody in the area has at least heard of people going out hunting for morel mushrooms. What makes this the perfect time of year for that, this and the last few weeks or so?
So these are really the only main edible mushrooms that are out this time of year. And I think part of the appeal is that they are a little bit hard to find, especially if you don't know what you're doing. And it's also a great to get out into the woods after a long winter in seclusion. And so the combination of those two things is what makes it appealing, I think.
So if for the uninitiated, how do you distinguish the morel from another kind of mushroom that you might see that might not be edible?
So I would recommend that your listeners Google the pictures, but they look like sponges, and they're hollow inside. There are some things called false morels that look a little bit like morels, but they are not hollow inside. And so that's the main thing to see, that these pits that are all around the outside of the mushrooms.
What kind of conditions are necessary for them to grow?
So first of all, it has to be wet enough, and then it has to be warm enough. And so usually the day temperatures are, you know, in the 60s to 70s, and probably more importantly, the nighttime temperatures are in the 50s. And the soil temperature getting it to about 50, but that's, you know, harder to measure if you don't have a thermometer. So the old wives and old husbands said that they look for morels when the oak leaves are the size of a squirrel's ear. So whatever that means.
So go out in the backyard, catch you a squirrel, measure the ears, and when the oak leaves are that size, you can go hunting for morels, huh?
Yeah. And so because of the temperature necessity, usually you start looking on the south-facing slopes where it gets warmer a little faster, and then move to the west slopes, then the east slopes, and then the north slopes are usually last in the season. And the ridge tops around here are mixed in. It depends on a lot of things, how their temperature goes. So, you know, that's, I think we're in kind of the south and western slope phase right now. By the time this airs, we might be in the eastern slope and ridge top. So, you know, and you know, it depends on how much rain you get too, because the mushrooms are 90 to 95% water. And so the water is necessary to make the mushrooms grow and for their cells to expand.
So my experience hunting morels was on my cousin's farm in Wesby, or right outside of Wesby. And we had a lot of fun doing that as kids. I didn't eat the mushrooms when I was a kid. I was not interested in that.
No.
But we left that to our parents, but we sure had fun running around looking for them.
You should always go mushroom hunting with kids, because they're little and they can look under stuff.
Yes.
And they're willing to climb up hills to go look under that elm tree way up yonder.
Yeah.
and they're willing to do that. So you should always take kids mushroom hunting with you.
Perfect. So if people don't know somebody with a farm out in the middle of nowhere where they can go look around for mushrooms, are there public lands where you can go morel hunting?
There are public hunting lands, for example, that are good spots for hunting, county parks. It's actually legal to collect edible mushrooms in most state parks as well in Wisconsin. So, you know, there are, you know, lots of other, you know, public land is what you're after.
Other than morels, are there other kinds of edible mushrooms that do grow in the area? I know you mentioned this not being an opportune time of year for those, but are there?
Right there. Most of the mushrooms in our area near La Crosse come out late, you know, it's July into middle of November, maybe. But the morels are out in the spring, and sometimes you can find chicken of the woods, which is a bright orange mushroom with yellow underside or white underside. And those I've seen as early as end of May, so we could be getting up on that season now. Sometimes we get the velvet stem mushroom, Flamuline of Ludipes, that comes out. And sometimes we get oyster mushrooms early in the season, and they can come up really any time of the year it's warm enough. And so the oyster mushrooms are also very good.
There's a lot of talk about safety when it comes to consuming mushrooms that you find in the wild. Is there
absolutely?
Is it just down to Googling what you've got and making sure you've got the right thing, or how can people make sure that they've got something safe to eat?
Actually, it takes some study to be able to do that. There are some that are pretty easy. Morels are relatively easy to ID once you know that there are false morels that are poisonous. And know what those look like. They don't really look that similar, but, you know, sometimes people get sort of desperate and they want something to really, really to be a morel, but it's not. So I learned a new word this week, pareidolia, which means that you if you want things to look like something enough, they look like it.
Really?
Like things that look like an angel in the clouds, or that look like the Virgin Mary in a piece of toast or something like that. And it's called pareidolia.
Pareidolia. Okay. That's a new one for me. Thank you.
It's a good word. I just learned it.
That's fantastic. I'm keeping that one. So in addition to mushrooms, there's plenty of other stuff that you can find out in the woods when you're walking about various greens and other things. What else do you look for when you're out for your walks?
Certainly the most popular of the wild plants at this time of year are ramps, which are wild leeks. And they are just what they say, they're wild leeks. The flavor is much stronger than the cultivated leeks, and they're much smaller. And so there are things you could confuse with it, like Lily of the Valley looks a lot like it, but Lily of the Valley is toxic. Ramps need to be collected responsibly. It takes them a really, really long time to grow. For example, I planted some in my yard it's been probably 15 years ago, and never harvested them. And they're now a patch maybe 6 feet across.
Okay.
And so it took them that long to grow. Should never take all of the ramps from one patch. Should probably only harvest the leaves and leave the bulb underground for more reproduction. Ideally you probably only take one leaf. They're usually three leaves. You should probably only take one from each plant so that that can continue to grow.
If you come across a grouping of ramps, would it be easy to tell whether someone has already been there? Like, in other words, someone's already harvested the amount that's responsible to take from this grouping. I should leave them alone.
Probably. That could happen. But usually that would be kind of in an urban area where there's a lot of traffic. And
okay.
Most of the time I'm collecting way out in the woods where nobody knows where to go.
So if
you look for leaves that are snipped, you look for disturbance of the soil, you know, where someone has pulled up things, you know, that is sometimes a problem. you know, I'm not totally opposed to people picking the bulbs, but you should even be less, you should be, well, put it this way, you should be more diligent about leaving most of them behind for the bulbs, because that's the major reproductive structure.
Yeah.
You know, they don't flower until August. So the leaves die back and then this flower shoot goes up. So it's really weird. It's a really weird life cycle.
So in addition to ramps, what else do you find that you, that's edible?
Surprisingly, I really like stinging nettle.
Okay. What do you do with stinging nettle?
I mostly will, there's a couple different ways. So you can just boil it. You know, add some butter and salt and whatever you like, and just eat that like that. Or sometimes I boil it partway and then I fry it. It's better than spinach as a green, I think. You have to be really careful when you're picking them. It's better to wear gloves, or else your fingers are going to, you know, sting for quite a while.
Yeah. It's called stinging nettle for a reason, right?
Yes, there is a reason. So I prefer the stinging nettle, not the wood nettle. So stinging nettle has opposite leaves on the stem, and wood nettle I don't eat, and that has alternate leaves on the stem.
You don't eat it. Is it edible? Or
I've heard of people eating it, but I'm not convinced. So use the Google and look at pictures of those.
Now,
to see the difference.
I know that in your commercialized salad mixes or whatever, you see dandelions from time to time. Dandelions that are out in our yards, are those edible as well?
They are edible as long as the yard is not sprayed with pesticides,
sure,
or herbicides. And so that's a, you know, that's a problem. You know, I'm not opposed to using responsible use of pesticides, but you don't want to eat them after that. And the same thing is true of wild violets. Wild violets are actually really good in the salad.
Oh, wow.
The green part is good. And the, you know, adding the flower in makes it kind of pretty, you know, a pretty looking salad. And they're a little bit sweet because of the sugar they're providing in there for the insects to come to fertilize them.
Now, you talked about morels and other mushrooms being out in the woods and in that kind of an environment. What kind of environment are people going to find things like the greens that you've been talking about and other things?
Those are mostly in the woods, too. They're in lawns, but if they're sprayed at all, I don't recommend eating anything out of your lawn because you don't know what they sprayed it with.
For somebody who doesn't have any experience in this, I mean, many of us have heard stories maybe of our grandparents or whatever going out and foraging for food like that. What's a good way for somebody to get started?
The best way to start learning about mushrooms in particular is to join a mycology club, a mushroom club. And we're fortunate enough that we started a club at UW-La Crosse that's open to the public for mycology. And so we have meetings, we have forays, and the best way to learn how to hunt something is to have someone show you, you know, take you out in the woods and show you a spot. Then get the idea where kind of ways to look and how to look. That it's really fun to hunt with other people, but they're of course competition too. So.
So you say there's a club. Do you meet often, or are your activities online at the moment, or are you able?
We're online right now. We did have one foray a couple of weeks ago, but I think we'll start having more of these forays where we go hunt mushrooms in the summer and into the fall. So we have a Facebook page, UW La Crosse Mycology Club, and so y'all can look for that and sign up for that, and the notices for forays and meetings get posted on there.
Okay. And so that would be, if somebody sees the meeting notice on Facebook or whatever, do they have to do anything to join, or can they just show up?
Anyone is welcome to come. There are some benefits of being a member as well, but anyone is welcome to come to our events, the general public and students and everybody else.
Speaking of mushrooms, I mean, obviously you have studied more than just edible mushrooms. What is the most exciting thing about mushrooms that people might not be aware of? People hear about the hallucinogenic effects of some of them and other kinds of things, but for centuries, mushrooms have been used in medicine and other kinds of things.
Right. And so there are, you know, lots of uses for mushrooms besides food. A lot of molds and things are used to make citric acid, for example, for coke. The steroids in the pill come from, you know, birth control pills come from fungi. So there's a lot of things like that. But there are also medicinal mushrooms that are gaining in popularity, things that you normally wouldn't just eat, but you might make a tea out of it, hot water extract of it. And there are, you know, some of those are available commercially and some of you got to go out and pick. So what was the other part of that?
No, I was just interested to know what, aside from stuff that's edible, what excites you about studying mushrooms?
Oh, and so I like the way that they are different from plants and animals, totally different. They, for example, they get their food by putting their hyphae, their filaments, through the food, and they dump their enzymes outside of their bodies and digest outside of their bodies. And then they absorb the small digested molecules and use them for metabolism.
Wow. That's amazing.
It's really weird.
So you referred to mushrooms as being something other than plants and animals. So, I mean, we might think of a mushroom as being a plant because it grows outside and it's not an animal. But
it turns out that fungi are more closely related to animals than to plants.
Okay. How is that?
So physiologically, a lot of the enzymes and all of the, and a lot of a lot of genetics is the same. And so it's pretty well accepted in scientific community that fungi are a sister group to the animals.
Very interesting.
So for example, I teach medical mycology as well, and it's really hard to cure a fungal infection of a person without killing the person, because there's so many things in common between the two that there are very few targets to hit to kill the fungus without killing the person. So we're closely related to fungi.
Interesting, interesting indeed. Thomas Volk is a professor of biology at the University of Wisconsin La Crosse. Tom, thank you very much for a very enlightening conversation. I've enjoyed it a lot.
Good. I'm glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking about the various things we find when we go outside. We've been talking about, obviously, mushrooms and various other things that you can forage in terms of food. Coming up next, we're going to be talking about bugs, those critters. They bite you. They get in your face. They're annoying, but they're also beneficial to our ecology. We'll talk about that balancing act coming up in just a moment. If you'd like more information about our show, it's available online at WPR.org/newsmakers. If you've got a question, a comment, a topic that you'd like us to cover in the future, you can always get in touch with us by emailing newsmakers@WPR.org. We'll be back in a moment. This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. From Wisconsin Public Radio, it's Newsmakers. I'm Ezra Wall in our Southwest Wisconsin studio on the campus of the University of Wisconsin La Crosse. Thank you very much for joining us today. We just heard an interesting conversation about foraging for food, looking for those wild mushrooms, morels, the big ones this time of year, of course, and other edible greens and things like that. We're now turning the page and talking about other things that you find in the great outdoors. Maybe you don't want to find some of these things, some of those critters that you come across, mosquitoes, ticks, flies, they bite you, but what else do they do? We're joined today by PJ Leash, who is known as the Wisconsin Bug Guy. You can find him on Twitter at WIBugGuy, and he's an extension entomologist with the University of Wisconsin Madison. PJ, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
So we're talking about bugs, and in this part of Wisconsin, we've got marshes all over the place. It's river country up here, And everybody is just bracing because when the weather warms up, there's going to be tons of mosquitoes outside.
Oh, yeah. And that's a common question I always get. And for me, the mosquito questions often start popping up kind of that first time we get a little bit of a warm spell in February or so. And everyone wants to know what's the outlook for the mosquito season. And it's really hard to tell at this point. And even now, it's still a little bit hard to tell. It turns out that in Wisconsin, we have close to 60 different species of mosquitoes, and each has their own unique story to tell. Their biologies are slightly different. They have preferences for slightly different types of water. So, for example, we have certain mosquitoes that specifically rely on the water that comes from melting snow. And for those mosquitoes, we often get a generation in the springtime, and then in many cases, they're done for the year. We don't see them again until the following year. We have some other mosquitoes that can be much more opportunistic. And what I mean by that is they can do very, very well when we have some heavy rains, which can cause temporary ephemeral pools. This could be some tire tracks in the mud that fill with water for a week or two. And under the right conditions, you have the water, you have it there long enough amount of time, you have enough warmth. You can go through a generation of some of those mosquitoes in about a week and a half or so, give or take. So there's a lot of different things that can go on. The main story I tell folks, though, is we still don't know, even at this point in the year, what the overall outlook is going to be for the rest of the year. And really a driver for that story is going to be the precipitation that we get in the coming weeks and coming months. That can have a really big influence. If we start out a year wet, we might see a big first batch of mosquitoes. But then if we ran into droughty conditions, that can really slow things down. So a lot of variability that can come into play with mosquitoes.
Now, in some parts of the world, and in fact, in some other parts of our country, it might be more common to hear about mosquitoes spreading disease of one kind or another. I lived in the South a long time. West Nile virus is a big concern down there. You hear around the world of people having, you know, malaria and dengue fever and all these other kinds of things. What about in this area? Are mosquitoes disease carriers in the Midwest?
Well, they are, but overall, our human health disease risk is relatively low. We still have concerns with diseases like West Nile, which does pop up from time to time. When you look at the statistics from DHS, Department of Health Services in the state, even in a bad, so-called bad year for West Nile virus, we might see somewhere between 50 and 60 cases in the state. So relatively low. In a year where it's relatively low cases overall, we may have single digit number of West Nile cases. So relatively low up here. Also, simply due to the types of mosquitoes that we have in Wisconsin, surrounding states in the upper Midwest, we don't have concerns at the moment with some of the diseases that have been in the news a lot. Things like dengue fever, chikungunya. We all recall Zika virus really, you know, blew up in the news about 4 or 5 years ago. And we simply don't have the right types of mosquitoes up here for those diseases to take hold. So we do still have concerns, things like West Nile virus. Last year, actually, in parts of kind of west central Wisconsin, we did have 2 cases of eastern equine encephalitis, which can actually be a fatal disease in some cases. So that one can be very serious. So there's some risk out there, but in the grand scheme of things, I personally worry much more about other arthropods like ticks, for example, where the risk can be much higher for those.
And that's exactly what you hear people talking about right now as they start to get out in the woods. The snow's gone, the weather's warm, and everybody's going out for those hikes for the first time and coming back with some ticks. How prevalent are ticks in our area? Is there a tick season? Are ticks bad one year and not the next year, or is it just something we always have to look out for?
Well, for the most part, they're always something we have to look out for. And somewhat similar to the mosquito situation I just described, we have a number of different tick species in Wisconsin. Now, there are certain ticks that you will just not encounter unless you go looking for them. We have some species that are specifically on rabbits. And unless you were hunting rabbits, you're just not going to find those types of ticks. We have some on woodchucks or other animals like that. We do have three species that humans can encounter either regularly or with some regularity. That would be the American dog tick, which many folks often refer to as the wood tick. And some good news about that one is even though it's pretty abundant and can be found more or less throughout much of the year, we have very little disease risk with it. It can technically transmit a disease called Rocky Mountain spotted fever and a few other things, but we very, very rarely see cases of those. The main tick of concern for us is the deer tick, also known as the black-legged tick. Because of its association with Lyme disease, we are at a time of the year where deer ticks are very, very active. So it's definitely a situation where Wisconsinites going out into the woods to look for morels or just going out to enjoy a nice weekend and going for a hike, you should be taking precautions. When you look at the statistics for the rate of infectivity, that's the rate or percentage of ticks carrying the microorganism responsible for Lyme. At the moment in the state, the average is about 20 or so percent of the juvenile deer ticks, and it's about 40-ish percent of adult deer ticks. So that's almost a coin flip in terms of if a deer tick bit you, if it's carrying Lyme or not. And in some areas that have been studied in Wisconsin, that rate of infectivity of adults is even closer to 60%. So that's really an alarming number. One other thing I would really like to highlight about deer ticks is we didn't have our first confirmed deer tick in Wisconsin until the late 1960s. So this is something that our grandparents living in Wisconsin, you know, 60 years ago or something like that, they didn't have to deal with this particular type of tick. It just wasn't around in our area. If you went in the 40s or 50s and you want to find deer ticks, you had to go down to a place like Texas to find them. Eventually, they got up here in enough numbers and were able to establish themselves that at the moment, they are found essentially statewide. I believe last time I checked with Susan Paskowitz, our medical entomologist, I think there's still two counties in Wisconsin. We haven't found deer ticks. They're probably out there in low numbers, but otherwise, they can be found statewide. When you look at the numbers of Lyme disease cases, last time I saw it, I think it was in the ballpark of about 3,000 or so cases, but there are some estimates from groups like the CDC that there's probably a lot of unreported, undiagnosed cases, and the real caseload may be many times higher than that. So it's definitely a concern for Wisconsinites.
We're talking to extension entomologist PJ Leash. You can find him on Twitter at WIBugGuy. And we've so far heard about mosquitoes and ticks, but I want to talk about mitigation a little bit. What precautions can people take to minimize the risk of being exposed, especially in the case of those deer ticks where they could actually catch a disease, but also mosquitoes, which are more or less just annoying?
Yeah, so the good news is a lot of the precautions overlap for both of those. So we can do a lot of things that will help prevent run-ins with both mosquitoes and ticks. Some of the simplest things, if you know that it's a bad mosquito season, or if you know that a certain park or natural area just seems to have a lot of ticks, perhaps a wise decision is just to avoid those areas outright or not go outside or stay in a screened-in porch if the mosquitoes are bad, for example. So avoidance can be a very helpful precaution to take. Another thing that can be really helpful is to wear long sleeve clothing. Now, as we get into the warmer months, you know, if it's 90 degrees in July, it's hard to put on long pants and a long sleeve shirt, even though that can be a physical barrier between our skin and these mosquitoes or ticks. But this time of the year, especially if it's cooler in the evening and maybe we're seeing some mosquito activity, that's a physical barrier, chemical-free way to prevent them from getting to your skin. So that can be a helpful approach. If you are going out into tick country or areas you suspect there could be ticks, again, wearing the long sleeve, especially pants, because ticks generally get on us from lower vegetation and can walk upwards. They can crawl upwards fairly quickly and easily start on your leg and get up to neck or, you know, your scalp, hairline, things like that. But wearing long sleeve pants, and especially if you were to tuck the pants into socks, you have a continuous barrier that's gonna make it harder for them to get in. There are also things like repellents. There are kind of the gold standard repellents like DEET. There are some other ones out there. Some folks just aren't fans of DEET for one reason or another. There's things like Picaridin, IR3535, and some other ones that are EPA registered. If folks are looking for a more kind of natural approach, there's a lot of recipes online for so many drops of this essential oil and that one. Those don't seem to really hold up based on scientific research, but there is an approved repellent EPA registered that contains oil of lemon eucalyptus. Does have a very strong smell associated with it, but it can be found at hardware stores and outing goods stores, things of that nature. So there's a number of repellents out there. If the mosquitoes are really bad, things like a head net might make a lot of sense. Or if you're simply sitting on your back deck wanting to have a cookout or barbecue, a really simple non-chemical approach would be to set up a box fan or two just to get some air movement. Mosquitoes with their small body mass, a decent breeze can often blow them off course and make it hard for them to get to you. So that's a very simple thing that a lot of folks can do, is just set up a fan or two on your back deck that can help keep them at bay.
What about the candles? People light the citronella candles and other things. Do those work?
Not really. They can work to a certain extent, but the repellency, it has a very short radius, so to speak. So if you are sitting with a citronella candle right at your feet, that probably will help a little bit. But in a lot of cases, you see folks light a citronella candle, put it out on a picnic table, and they're standing 10 feet away, and they just don't have that type of repellency. So it's over a very, very short distance. One other thing I should mention, especially with relevance to ticks, is making sure to do tick checks. And a reason for that is when a deer tick bites you, it actually takes a decent amount of time for that tick to transmit Lyme disease if it's carrying that microorganism. And realistically, based on research studies, the tick is going to have to be attached somewhere in the ballpark of about 36 to 48 hours or longer. So even if you go out morel collecting for a day and you're out in the woods, if you come in and you check yourself for ticks and remove a deer tick, if it's only been attached for a few hours, that is not long enough generally for transmission of Lyme disease. So that can be a very, very helpful precaution when it comes to ticks.
Some people might think of these mosquitoes and ticks and everything and say, all right, they get in my way. But of what benefit are they in our ecosystem? What is the role of something like ticks in our ecosystem?
Yeah, so for me, in my mind, it's really hard to make much of a case for ticks. Now, if we were to put ourselves in the shoes of a tick, you know, they're simply trying to reproduce and perpetuate their species, but they're not a major food source for other animals. I mean, there certainly are vertebrates that will groom themselves and feed on ticks and things like that, but they just have a very small body mass. So they're not a significant food for other creatures. They're not really doing pollination, anything like that. So it is a little bit harder for me to make a case for ticks. For mosquitoes, they do some beneficial things out there. The larvae and aquatic environments can be food for other organisms that could be other insect larvae, like dragonfly larvae or other aquatic insect larvae might be feeding on them, small fish and things of that nature. The adult mosquitoes, keep in mind, only the females take blood meal. So the male mosquitoes, they're going to flowers for nectar, and females will also go to flowers for nectar on occasion as a carbohydrate source. So they may be doing a little bit of pollination along the way too. So they can do a couple things there, being food for creatures, other creatures, and also do a little bit of pollination too.
Another thing people are going to encounter as they're outside are different kinds of flies that bite. Are some of the precautions you talked about, wearing long sleeves, wearing maybe a net over your face if they're really bad, some of the repellents, do those things work on the flies as well?
They do, yes. So very similar how I said we have overlap in the precautions between ticks and mosquitoes. Many of the things we do for mosquitoes will help with some of these other biting flies as well. Again, it's things like the long sleeves to have a barrier. If they're really bad, a mosquito head net, mesh head net. Sometimes if it's really warm, I've seen folks wear an entire mesh bodysuit just so they can go out and still wear shorts and t-shirt and mow their lawn. Again, it's about having that physical barrier between the insect and their skin, so that can help. Unfortunately, the repellents don't seem to work quite as well against some of the other biting flies. Some biting flies rely very heavily on cues such as movement and color, and the repellents might work a little bit, but not as well as they do against things like mosquitoes.
We're talking to PJ Leash. He's an extension entomologist with the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and you're listening to Newsmakers. You can, of course, find information about our show at WPR.org/newsmakers. You can email us. It's newsmakers@WPR.org. I look forward to hearing from you. We're going to continue our conversation with PJ just a moment. This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. It's Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Ezra Wall in La Crosse. Thank you very much for joining us today. We're talking to PJ Leash. He's the Wisconsin Bug Guy, an extension entomologist with the University of Wisconsin-Madison. PJ, we were talking about precautions that people can take when they're out in the woods or out in their yards enjoying a little bit of the nice weather against flies and mosquitoes and ticks and those kinds of things. Let's talk about some of the other bugs that people might hear about. We've been seeing a lot of news about cicadas lately, and of course there are cicadas that are around our area. Is this brood of cicadas that's coming out this year going to affect us? Will there be an opportunity for us to hear or see those?
So for us here in Wisconsin, the short answer is no, unless you want to hop in the car and drive. And from Madison here, I'd probably have to drive maybe a good 4 to 5 hours down to parts of Indiana, East Central Illinois. You'll pick up some of the brood 10 that we're hearing about in the news. So from La Crosse, you know, add probably another 2 hours to that. This brood 10 or brood X, it's a Roman numeral X. It's a periodical cicada that pops out every 17 years. And we started getting some reports from southern states. So in the coming weeks, we're going to see a lot more activity in places like Tennessee, Georgia, North Carolina, Indiana, Ohio, a little bit of Illinois, Michigan, and then another big batch over in the Pennsylvania area as well. So those can be found in about 15 or so states total. We do actually have a group of periodical cicadas. It's brood 13, which last emerged back in 2007, meaning that their 17-year cycle is coming up here in 3 years, 2024. So if you do want to see these periodical cicadas here in Wisconsin, you'll just have to wait 3 more years. We can find them in the southern tier or two of counties in Wisconsin. So we can sometimes find some in Dane County and surrounding areas. If you really wanted to see them, probably the best chance to do that would be to go down to Lake Geneva area in Walworth County. We tend to get lots of reports from that part of the state. But again, we've got to wait a couple more years before those are out.
And not something that's going to affect us up here in the Cooley region.
No. Again, I've seen on the distribution map about southern, maybe third of Wisconsin, but that's about as far north as they get in the state.
So I saw an interesting thing walking around in my neighborhood. I saw a yard that was beginning to look a little bit unkempt, and I thought, well, this isn't very neighborly. Well, then I come across the yard, and I immediately felt bad. I was guilted because there's a sign out in the yard that says, "No mow May. Look at this. We're protecting bees and other kinds of things." What is this No Mow May movement? I haven't heard of that before.
Yeah, so this is a movement essentially to leave floral resources out for bees and other pollinators. And that can include in our own yards things like dandelion and clover and things of that nature. Now, to us, we might refer to those plants as weeds. A weed, if you look at some of the definitions of weeds out there, it's simply an unwanted plant for that particular spot. So if you're really particular about your lawn, you know, you may not tolerate any dandelions. But other folks, you know, can tolerate them more or less. But to us, they may be a weed in some cases. To insects, though, that could be breakfast, lunch, and dinner, a source of nectar and pollen. There was some interesting work about 10 or so years ago by Dr. Jonathan Larson, who was at University of Kentucky at the time. And for his PhD work, he looked at urban and suburban lawns with dandelions and clover and surveyed what insects he could find associated with those. And he basically found somewhere in the ballpark of about 50 50 or so different species of bees and other pollinators, just using dandelions and clover in folks' lawns in their yard. So a lot of insects can go to those plants, and especially early in the season, we don't have that many other flowering plants out at the moment compared to maybe a little bit later in the year, like June, July. There's a lot more diversity out. So at this point in the year, having some of those floral resources can be really helpful for bees and other pollinators.
So in terms of those pollinators, especially the bees, I feel like bees kind of get a bad rap. They get lumped in our area with all of the other flying, stinging things, your wasps, your hornets, your, you know, yellow jackets, all those kind of things. And honeybees just generally don't bother people that much. And they're so beneficial. And yet they're at least in recent years, they've been in such danger. Is that still the case?
Yeah, we definitely still are hearing about risks and declines for bees, but also other insects in general. We're hearing more and more in the news all the time about insects declining across the globe, essentially. So we do have concerns about bees and other pollinators and other insects. Your comment was very interesting, though. I mean, folks hear the term bee, and they often jump to the conclusion that this is something that is going to sting me. But as you mentioned, a lot of cases, honeybees really aren't going to bother you unless you maybe got too close to a hive. Same kind of thing with bumblebees, unless you really got close to their nest in the ground in an old chipmunk burrow or something like that, they're probably not going to mess with you. If you think about the bee situation overall in Wisconsin, we have somewhere between 400 to 500 different species of bees. And the vast majority of these bees are actually solitary species, meaning that they live alone. We have a few social bees, bees that live as colonies. These are things like honeybee and bumblebee. Honeybees can have colonies with thousands, tens of thousands of workers. Bumblebee colonies tend to be smaller, often in the range of maybe 100, sometimes more, sometimes less. And of course, if you have a colony of relatives to defend, if the colony is disturbed, some of those workers are going to come out and sting or chase off whatever is there. But these solitary bees are really interesting. Most of these live in the ground, and their nest is going to look essentially like an anthill. There's going to be a little hole, a little pile of dirt or substrate. They're very fond of sandy soil because it's easy to dig in. And then the female that's dug this little nest in the ground, she has to go out and do all the hard work of collecting pollen and nectar, bring it back to that tunnel, and she basically is provisioning these little cells in the ground. So she stashes away some pollen and nectar, lays an egg, and then basically walls it off. Her egg is going to hatch, and that bee larva is going to have all the resources that it needs to go from that young larva stage to a new adult bee. And because these are solitary nesters, they don't have a bunch of adult relatives to defend, so they're very, very docile. You can literally get within inches of these to take pictures of them, and they don't really seem to be bothered or spooked by you at all, and so they're very, very unlikely to sting. So in my mind, when I hear a term like ground bee, I tend to think of very gentle, docile insects. And in my mind, they're almost like miniature teddy bears when you see them. They're just very, very fuzzy in appearance.
I was at my storage unit the other day, and I saw these little nests several different places. They were made, it looked like they were made of mud almost, or dirt. It was all dried out, and some of it was on some things that I needed to move around in the unit, and so I chipped them off, and I saw that there were bees of some kind in there, and of course they were quickly dispatched. But what are things like that? What kind of a bee is that, and should I have just left it alone?
Well, so in your case, based on the description, I would almost wonder if you might have bumped into some of our solitary wasps that we refer to as mud daubers. And there's okay. Some species that the nest looks kind of like a straight tube, often vertically aligned. There's some other species where it looks like someone just took a handful of wet mud and threw it on the wall and just kind of plastered it there.
That's it.
Yeah. So those can be very common overall, just like the solitary ground bees I described. These are creatures that the female each has her own nest, so she's generally non-aggressive. For some of those species, what the female does is instead of getting pollen and nectar like the bee does. She hunts prey insects, or in some cases spiders, brings those back to the nest to provision these little cells, and then lays her egg in there, and her young will feed upon the prey that she collected. So it's a somewhat similar story to the solitary bees. And again, these insects tend to be really non-aggressive when it boils down to it.
Well, these one of them, the one I mentioned, was on the side of a box that I needed. But in terms of if I see them in other places in the unit, I can just leave them alone and they're probably not going to bother anybody?
Right.
Okay. Right. Okay. Good deal. Well, it's an interesting conversation about bees, and especially the need for flowers for all the pollinators this time of year. But speaking of the other flying and stinging insects that we hear about, another one that comes up is last year the unfortunately nicknamed murder hornets that were a year or two ago that were all the rage to talk about, these Asian giant hornets. Are those ever going to make their way over here, or are they even, you know, are they a big deal anymore?
Well, so I haven't heard any more reports this year, but about a year ago, the Asian giant hornets really blew up in the news. There were some big stories by New York Times and the like, and in my mind, and in many entomologists' minds, it's unfortunate these insects were referred to as murder hornets, because it made it sound like these insects are out to get mankind. They are very large social wasps. They can potentially be dangerous if someone were to get very close to a nest, because they are a colonial insect. They've got relatives to defend, and so they can do that. But for the most part, our risk here in Wisconsin is very low. We don't know for sure, are they ever going to get here? That's a big question. We just don't know at this point. But at the moment, these insects, the Asian giant hornet, have only been found in North America in very far northwestern Washington state and nearby parts of British Columbia. And they haven't moved outside of that zone thus far. So we have a lot of questions. Is the climate even going to be hospitable or suitable for them elsewhere, say east of the Rockies? Is it too cold in the upper Midwest? We don't know, but based on the slow spread we've seen thus far, the nearest sighting to us here in Wisconsin is about 1,400, 1,500 miles away. So really low risk for us in the state. I will mention, though, that we do have a handful of lookalikes, insects that are wasps that are relatively large, maybe an inch and a half long, are often mistaken for Asian giant hornets. So last summer in particular, I had lots and lots of reports of folks thinking they had found Asian giant hornet, emailing me, panic email, I found them. And in every single case, it was one of these native insects that just happened to be a little bit large and, a little bit intimidating because of that aspect. But we have not found them in Wisconsin or anywhere close. So risk is low for us here in the state.
It must be frustrating as an entomologist to let either social media or the media itself nickname something because they're going to pick something that's catchy. I'm remembering from my childhood all the stories about killer bees that were just going to take over the United States, and we would not even be able to live here in 5 years after these killer bees arrived. And that just seems like another example of something being misnamed, really, because of lack of education on the issue. Maybe animals being misunderstood.
Yeah, and there's a lot that can go along with the name. And as you just alluded to, sometimes you get a catchy name that sticks, and it's just stuck with that name for the long run. The killer bees you mentioned, originally another nickname for those was actually Bravo bees, because they were such hardworking bees. And so certain beekeepers were fond of that particular trait of them. With these Asian giant hornets being called murder hornets in some cases, I mean, they can pose some pretty significant risk to honeybee colonies. But in terms of the human health impact, it seems to be kind of overinflated in my mind. When this story came out, I went to the Japanese government demographics website and was looking at some of the causes or mortality data and things like that. And there were about twice as many people in Japan, the native range of this wasp, that die every year slipping in their own bathtubs. So to put that in perspective, it was like maybe 10 to 15 per year died from these particular wasps, but double that in terms of slipping into bathtubs. So again, it's really kind of overinflated in some regards.
It's all a matter of perspective, I guess. PJ Leash is the Wisconsin Bug Guy. You can find him on Twitter at WIBugGuy. He's an extension entomologist with UW-Madison. PJ, I've really enjoyed our conversation today. Thank you very much for being on Newsmakers.
Thanks for having me.
This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this conversation again or our previous conversation with Tom Volk, a professor of biology from UW-La Crosse, talking about mushrooms and other edible plants you find in the wild, you can find this show on our website. It's wpr.org/newsmakers. If you've got a question for the show, something you'd like us to find some information about, or if you've got an idea for a future program, we would love to hear from you. Our email is newsmakers@wpr.org. Thanks a lot to our producer today, Dawn Jewell, and John Davis for helping us out as well, and for the rest of the La Crosse staff. I'm Ezra Wall, tripping all over my tongue today. We'll see you next time on Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio.